Peter, had I known you were going to go on at that length, I would have given them dark glasses to hide my blush. But I really am the one who needs the dark glasses, because how often does one get to be between two sunshine boys? It's good to be back. 2 days from now, it'll be 14 years since the last time I addressed this group. And almost no group I know has lasted 14 years. So I'm looking forward to being back 2 days short of the next 14 years, and we'll see how the U.S. is doing after all that time. The pro and con of religious communication. My goal in the half hour ahead is to pinpoint as precisely as I can where we are in religious communication today in America, where the central problem seems to be, and the beginning of some of the ways to address it. Remembering that when we talk about communication, we're not here talking about all the forms of it. A mother's love can be a form of religious communication. A sacrament can be a form of religious communication. And most of you are professionally involved with only one dimension of it, public relations and publicity, which I define as the intentional generation of images that reflect the image and intention of the church and that may serve as an instrument for the church's listening and growth. If that's my goal, you may well be asking, if lunch hasn't hit you that hard yet, what does any of that have to do with the title? Nothing. Then why is there a title? They once asked St. Augustine, after he'd written a book on the Trinity, whether he felt satisfied with it, and he said, no, it was better than silence. We can't say nothing, we must say something. And on a gray winter day, when I got the phone call, we're going to press with a program, what will the title be? I hadn't the faintest idea. I said, you fill it in. So it's the Sunshine Boys' invention. It's obviously a pickup on the book, because the publisher of the book, whose name wasn't mentioned, Word, bought my ticket here today to save you money. I could stand on my head and turn back in front to do the pro and con to get the idea of the book enforced in your mind, but that's obviously enforced now since Peter threw it at the, props.
This is a...
That's how he reviews other publishers' books. Secondly, his letter to me, written on April Fool's Day, when I asked, what am I talking about, said, well, the title is Pro and Con of Religious Communication, and no matter what I put in, I know you have something you're going to want to say anyhow, which is true. Every year I call into the dean and I get a call from the dean. What are you going to call your course this year? So I have a speech I want to make, though nobody else has heard it before. By the way, I found in my files the speech from April 10th, 1962. I read it and I still believe it. And there will be something, at least, of the pro and con here, because as anyone who knows me well knows, I have a dialectical dimension. My sons always, when they ask me a question, say, Dad, why do your answers always have so many on the other hands in them? So I will give with one hand and take with the other. But I do want to address what I think is the central problem today. The central problem for religious communication in our society is not that there's not enough religion around, not that there's not enough religious interest around, by any projection into the 20th century, in the 200th year of this society, there's far more religion than anybody expected to have available. The problems in religious communication result from the kind of religions we have and the locations. They are doing a lot of things for people, but the way they do things for people creates problems for communicators. For example, in a secular world, and in many ways ours is that, the more religious-looking religion gets, the harder it is to communicate through public relations, because the less public it gets. In our society, when people say so-and-so is very religious, they usually mean withdrawn from the public, withdrawn from the culture, not full of the passions and juices and temptations that other people have. They are blue-veined, disapproving, pious people. And to have a religious experience means you go deeper and deeper and deeper into that sector and have less and less to do with anything around you. That is a little bit of a problem if you're trying to communicate the meaning of religion for a whole culture. In contrast to some moments in our past, I'm teaching a course right now at the university on the 1500s, and one of the hardest things to get across to students is why people killed each other for religion in those days. Heresy was a civil offense in the Ottoman Empire, the Safavid Empire of Persia, the Timuri Empire in India. It was a civil offense in Muscovite Orthodoxy in Spain, and it remained a civil offense in the Protestant Reformation. There's not only a bloody Mary, but there's a bloody Elizabeth, and a bloody Luther, and a bloody Calvin. And they were not killing people because heresy was a little deviation from a theological truth, but because it was a threat to civil order. That's not our society. You quit the Methodists and join the Catholics, and next year they'll welcome you back with open arms if you come back to Methodism. The civil society has different standards. You leave the U.S. in 1968, you cross the Canadian border, and you're not back yet. That's something of how religion was regarded in earlier societies. It was the custodian of the orthodoxy. That isn't true for anybody today, and therefore what you're communicating doesn't seem as urgent. It seems private. It seems wholly a matter of choice. Or to take a more recent example, as Perry Miller has said of the Great Awakening in America that occurred just before the Revolution, these weren't just individuals being converted out of Northampton or Charleston or wherever, but somehow the whole interests of the whole community were involved. And again, you might be telling the story of a religious experience, including a mass evangelistic rally, but those who aren't there do not feel their interests involved. Religion is not inconveniencing them, except for the traffic jams. It's not in the way. And it doesn't portend any special hope for them. It doesn't have a bearing on you the way it does in, let's say, even a small town in Utah where the entire community would be Latter-day Saint, and not only the worship, but all the practical details of life are determined by the church. There again, it is not hard to communicate religion because there is, in a sense, no non-religious world. But we're in a different situation. I'm arguing we have as much religion as ever, but for the communicator, it is mislocated. How often do you show a picture of somebody getting converted or having hands raised up at a Pentecostal rally or kneeling in prayer and expecting not to cross the low thresholds of boredom of people in our society? And the other problem with the location, not only are we not official and an obstacle to people, we cannot tax, we cannot coerce, we cannot raise armies, but we're located in a difficult way for the communicator too, because most of you, including those of you whose base is the local congregation, aspire to communicate something about the faith of the people there beyond its borders. I know the church sometimes doesn't look as if it's doing that way. I have a friend who lives in Marina Towers, these two symbols of Chicago. The parking lot goes up like this. Second City always used, comedians used to say they were designed that way so in an atomic attack you could screw them down into the ground. I have a friend who lives in there and is part of an experimental Christian community. This is made up of people who are disaffected by a conventional parish life. And he said, one of the things is the typical parish that he used to be a member of looked a lot like the Sears Roebuck where he worked. Picture everybody getting to work at 9 in the morning and then locking the doors and selling each other things and performing services for each other. Well, you in the communication business are not content with that image of a local church, even if that's the main institution that you're representing. You want it to have an impact beyond. But we're in a nation with several hundred thousand local churches. First Baptist doesn't care normally about what First Methodist is doing as an institution, unless negatively, if it's undercutting the tickets for the bowling banquet or whatever. And as the people in Newsweek, Time, U.S. News, National Observer, or wherever will tell you, they have a great deal of difficulty communicating religious news because people of one denomination don't feel that the news of a local church at another denomination will ordinarily affect them at all. So when an editor of the Sunday Times Week in Review section took me aside once and said, suppose you were editing this. You know our readers. You're a person of conscience who not only has a feeling for news, but also would like to be sure not to bother people with the trivial, but don't want them to overlook the important and necessary. What would you put in these years in the name of religion? And what would I tell him? What could I tell him? The size of revival crowds doesn't interest them very much, though it may impress those who are there, and it may impress a lot of us. It doesn't impress them. Ohio State Stadium and 5,700 other, or 2,900 other stadiums fill up every Saturday afternoon without so much as one advertisement, one advanced person, or whatever. You open the gates and 101,000 people are in Ann Arbor or wherever. So the crowds aren't going to do it. Where are the movements? And I have to say, I don't know of any big movements right now. I know a lot of little movements. I was telling Marshall Strauss and friends before, I'm a part of a lot of them. I'm on some 30 letterheads of causes, and they're all losing. And if you really want to sign me on, you might as well sell tickets to the Titanic. We're going down. Nobody's very afraid of these movements. It's not where the news is these days, I'll tell this communicator. I'll say, no, really, the religious news that's to be communicated today tends to be local, localized, up close, immediate, malleable, responsive, where the people are. As I say those things, any of you who has a Christian gospel heart in you must feel a little pitter-patter. Isn't that what it's about? Isn't that wonderful? Yes, it is. But we don't only live locally. As every person in the communicating business knows, but as a lot of those people locally don't, they're also being shaped by images that come from without. We are involved in world battles of imagery and symbolization, and we have very few defenses against them. And the people who, therefore, are very loyal in their local churches and doing very exciting things there also find many of the basic dimensions of their lives unreported on, ungrasped by anyone else, and uncommunicated. We live locally, but not only locally. That's where you're in a strategic spot, and I'm going to close a little later with some reference to what that spot means. How do you face the situation, then, in that religion may today be widespread, but not spread to the other centers of powers of the culture, and may be pervasive and deep locally, but there's no way, evidently, to connect up these locales these days? I think the first therapy or solution or strategy always is to know where we are, and maybe those two little things that I've just mentioned are the realities so close to us that we sort of overlook them. My favorite historian, a mid-19th century Swiss named Jakob Burckhardt, says that history books really deceive us because the most important things in any generation don't get written down precisely because they're taken for granted and they're that up close. We write down the exception. We write down what surprises people. That's what makes news. We don't see what's up close. And so we don't see normally that the basic reality about our religion is that the more religious we get, the less it seems to have to do with the other publics. And the more religious we get locally, the less we seem to have to do with the world in all of its various forms that we'd like to reach with communication. This is a way of saying that if you're like I am and don't think about it, you probably also like I are geared to the decades in which your own attitudes toward communication were formed. For most people in this room, that's the 50s or the 60s. And this formation equips us all very well to fight previous wars, to interpret past actions. And I want to spend a little bit of time on analyzing what that means. I think that the basics of what we wish to communicate don't change that much from generation to generation or decade to decade. Ask the Christian groups of America what it is that they're about, and most of them would give you some translation or other of words like meaning and salvation and belonging and purpose and value. And our nation is a nation in which we don't have the feeling that we are being saved. We know that religion is about community, and we look out and know that never have so many seemed so lonely. Arnold Weber, a German sociologist, says you can kill a person with an apartment as well as with a gun or an axe. It just takes a little longer. We're lonely, we're separated from each other, from our roots, from our tradition, from the people who are or would be or might be important to us. We don't know what shape the family should take in the next generation. We know it's subjected to every force around it, but we haven't found alternative ways to prop it up or give it meaning. We don't know to what degree the welfare of a welfare state should take up the space that the deeds of Christian love used to do. We really don't know the basic things in that area. We're out to communicate any good news on those fronts. We don't know how to take care of the earth. It's as if we're starting from scratch. We really don't know. We get rid of one pesticide and pick up a new disease. We get rid of one dye and pick up a new spoliage. We find one way to remove one kind of pollution, and we find that it only adds another. We know almost nothing yet about life process or when it begins, or what is a cell, or who dare end it, or how. We're starting from scratch. We may be changing human nature in the test tube before long, and no one's ready for that. And so we should communicate wherever, anywhere, anyone gives a clue of an understanding of care of the earth. The person, does anybody of you know? I haven't the faintest idea why the drug contagion erupted the way it did some years ago and did what it did to the safety of the cities. I don't know. I only know that nobody else knows either. We don't know much about what we ought to do to impart meaning in the midst of leisure to the life of the aged who get many more years to have no meaning than before. As the woman at Sun City said when they asked her at the 103rd shuffleboard or 210th bridge game, what was her purpose in life? To keep the ever-living juices flowing. We don't really know what that's to mean yet. Some of you are working on it. We haven't found a way yet to communicate any of those signals to the larger society. We know little about the meaning of fidelity and commitment in a time when casual intimacy is easy to acquire, but depth is hard. There are plenty of people working on it, in the churches and around them. But most of the character of the religion we have doesn't seem to be addressing it, so you're always in the process of having to look for the exception. And when you find that exception, I'm arguing, you'll normally find it in a locale that's easily overlooked and that's hard to bring to people's attention. I don't think we're going to stay where we are. Culture never does. Our society is either going to move in the years ahead toward a far more collective life. Robert Heilbronner pictures at the end of business civilization a kind of a mild Maoist society which will have its single, one, mildly coerced religion, which they'll probably call Christianity. Somebody said that if you ever turn fascist in America, you would call it anti-fascism. And if you'd ever turn atheist in America, you'd have to call it Christianism. We may be going in that direction, or we may be going toward a hyper-individualism, do your own thing. Both these tendencies are strong, and what we're celebrating in our 200th year is a very delicate, fragile, probably ephemeral nation and set of churches free to believe, free to share. So I'm arguing that in the 70s, we don't know the basic things we want to do. We do know there are some people addressing them. We don't know how to get their story out or heard or read or seen or listened to. And we don't, in part, as I've hinted, because I think we are captive of the decade of our formation. For me, the 50s. For anybody younger than that, 60s. For those of you older than that, 50s. Because I don't think that the Depression mentality has had much chance, and World War II was seen as an exception in national life. So most people in power today are shaped in either one of these two generations. 1945 or 50 till about 1960. Religious communication, I think, worked on the model of the religious group against the world. Internationally, it meant an over-againstness. It was the years of the Cold War. We were on a Christian crusade against atheistic communism, and that really ought to unite us all. Go to the church of your choice, said the billboards, on the assumption that somehow, if everybody went, we would have the nation we needed. And religion could communicate its value to the society instrumentally. We are useful to you. Religious communications against the world meant that we were in the task of encroaching upon and trying to get back some of the territories we'd yielded to what we called the secular. Secular was the dirtiest word of the 50s. Peter Berger said he used to sit there and listen to evangelists and preachers knock the world for being secular, and then telling everybody to leave the world and turn their back on it and become a part of the cause. And he said, that's a lot like blonde parents criticizing a blonde daughter for being blonde. You gave birth to that secular order when you turned your back on the world in the name of religion. But now we wanted to regain a little bit, and the best way to do that was to build large institutions. The GIs were back. They were married, they and their spouses and their children and their families seeking meaning and belonging and overcoming anxiety and a justification of a way of life. And the church of your choice in your neighborhood made it easy. Those 10 years in the Lutheran pastorate that are part of my biography, fortunately for statistics, occurred in those years. I looked like a real hotshot in the record books because you couldn't keep them away. A member of those two architectural guilds, honorary societies, because I was off dedicating somebody's church almost every week, somewhere or other. I don't get invited to that anymore, not because I've lost interest in architecture, but there aren't any new buildings to dedicate. There was a strong residual sense in the 50s that the churches represented block power, BLOC type power. In Chicago, you were worried about the clout of the cardinal. I can remember meetings of the four C's, Columbia Journalism School, Commonweal Christian Century, and Commentary, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, Atheist, in which we would talk about the urgent issues of society, and it actually made a difference. I'll never forget the day in which Monsignor Lally of the Boston Pilot heard some Protestants say, "For us, it's a big difference between a sin and a crime. And can't you at the Boston Pilot lay off a little bit and let some of these anti-birth control measures that you don't agree with get off the books?" And he said, "I guess so, we can." And they laid off, and Massachusetts voted a different way. That does not happen in the 70s. You can put up an Ellen McCormick on an anti-abortion ticket. You can put up somebody to do in Congressman Symington in pro-life St. Louis, Missouri. And the Catholic voters in the Catholic precincts of the Catholic wards vote for the other candidate. Block power has disappeared, and you are not communicating for institutions that by nature will make people fall down when you say boo. In the 60s, communication, I think, went through a fundamentally different model. Now not against the world, but attracted to the world in certain specific forms. Sputnik, JFK, Vatican II, civil rights, Vietnam, utopia, new creation as metropolis, secular city, honest to God. The conservative churches, as well as the moderate and the liberal churches, having heady dreams of changing the world, perhaps rather suddenly. The torch was passed. It was a dream, by the way, for people in the world of the media. It was a nightmare decade for people who had to communicate this images of their denominations because the two didn't often square. Not many Catholic diocese was claiming the Berrigans. Presbyterians weren't advertising the Robert McAfee Browns. They didn't welcome the publicity they were getting over the Angela Davises. It was a period of ecumenical convergence, the Vatican Council, the peak years for the Protestant and Orthodox ecumenical movements. The dream that the global village and spaceship Earth might now be experienced in the human family, then known as the family of man, if you can remember the words that long ago, were vivid images. And theology, again, more readily the liberal and moderate, but again, all theology is out to appropriate the secular and to retrieve some of that given back space. At the Fontainebleau, Billy Graham put it best when he said, "The first conversion is from the world to Christ, and the second conversion is from Christ back to the world." And we took that back to the world very seriously. As an annual writer on religion for World Book and Britannica, it's interesting to me to see what was religious news in the early 60s, and it was always public sector news. Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Pope John, and the like. So that in 1965, after the great civil rights legislation, Senator Richard Russell, who'd opposed it, and Senator Hubert Humphrey, who'd been for it, both said, A, it's those damn churches, or B, we couldn't have done it without the aid of religion. Those of you in communication had one fundamental problem there, and that is that you were being pulled apart, not over the internal dynamics, but over the way people in the church were being pulled by societal forces over which church leaders had little control. There was a left and a right, and a pro-black and an anti-black, and a pro-Vietnam and an anti-Vietnam, and you could talk theology and word of God and morals or whatever, and you were spitting into the wind. People had made their minds up already, and it was your task to communicate what was left of what held together. And that world is gone. Churches are still fighting, but instead of fighting each other as they fought in the 50s, or fighting within themselves because they're pulled apart, they're fighting over internally generated issues in the 70s. The public has a little interest in them, because conflict is more interesting than the absence of conflict. Most of you don't welcome communicating all the stories of the Episcopal battles ahead next September, or Catholics and Southern Baptists fighting over charismatics, or we Missouri Lutherans fighting over everything, or whatever. If you're in the business of communicating, you'd like to suggest that Christ Church is a reconciling circle that might just possibly lead people from some of that conflict. But the conflict itself is an indicator of what has happened in religion. The fact that we're now fighting over internal issues suggests that people are back home, regathering after a great deal of exposure. They're regathering and taking it very seriously. I often ask myself, what's to fight over in a denomination? It hardly defines anything. Tell me you're Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopal, or whatever. You haven't told me much about yourself. Tell me you're Catholic, you tell me nothing about yourself. Unless you say I'm a Catholic Pentecostal, then you tell me everything about yourself. If you're a member of a subgroup or emphasis group, but the denominations as such, as you all know, aren't rich. The enemies of the church are always out to say how fat we are on budget. $80 billion worth of property, which is $9 billion more than the B-1 bomber will cost, and $20 billion less than this year's defense budget. That's how much in 200 years of national life or five centuries in this hemisphere we've piled up in the terms of property. That ain't much less than 1 year's defense. And we're fighting over it. I think, to put the best construction on, what we're fighting over is how to define the traditions that the denominations remain custodians of. We're trying to define what it is that they pointed to, because we are on a search to know who we are. And that's why people don't want to let go. They don't want to be put out of the denominations. They don't want to yield to the victors or whatever. And you are a religious communicator in a vastly different world. I said there's a lot of religion around. I didn't say there's only religion around. We are still a secular world, I think. Langdon Gilkey, my colleague, says, secularity is to us what Hellenism was to the Greeks. It's what you are unless you think about being something else. Otherwise, why are we so surprised when we find an occasional Christian artist, writer? Boy, C.S. Lewis gets worked over 23 times a week. You know, 20th century and a writer and a Christian. W.H. Auden, T.S. Eliot, Dorothy Sayers. We shouldn't be surprised in a culture that we're truly religious or Christian. It's our way of knowing that deep sectors of our culture are secular and haven't been confronted by religion. Or most of the religion is confronted by is this very diffuse kind of religion that Thomas Lipman calls invisible religion, the religion of the high-rise apartment, the do-it-yourself guru of the week, seek your friendly neighborhood astrologer kind of religion, which has no social force because no two people link up in it. That's all over the place, and you're communicating in the midst of it. What are we doing these years? We've bracketed most cosmopolitan questions. A crazy hat contest in the church, or a doctor talking about a cancer cure, or a charismatic talking about prayer life, will draw. Bring in somebody from UNESCO. Bring in somebody who's talking about Bangladesh or Biafra or wherever, and you can hold your meeting in a phone booth. If only the world were addressable only in the terms of the local, we'd be well off. None of us can unload all our speeches in one day, and this little one I cooked up just for you can't remind you of all the ways in which I can celebrate the local. I would not have been a pastor had I not believed that, and I wouldn't be trying to teach a new generation of people entering these fields the importance of the local if I didn't believe that. But we are not only local, and that's the strategic place at which the communicator is operating today. If you're ever needed, you're needed now. A little parable. The Martys joined a lot of other people in our little town at the edge of Chicago in an anti-leaf-burning crusade. Leaf-burning, if you'll recall, was the only pleasant form of pollution. Remember? Once in a while, I still get in a corrupt town where you burn leaves, and right? Autumn leaves, nothing like it. But we were fighting pollution, and we finally won that battle, and we won it. We now put it in plastic bags for somebody else to burn it and pollute somewhere else. But we won that battle. And then somebody pointed out, having won it, in a year, our town didn't spew as much waste into the air by burning leaves as the Stickney sewage disposal plant right near us does per day. So Father Doobie in the campaign against pollution had to get the blacks who live on one side of it and the white ethnics who live on the other, who weren't supposed to have anything to do with each other, to organize in their churches and voluntary associations and make their way to City Hall, which once they got over fainting to see the coalition that had been formed here, did something about it. And that's a little parable. I think it's tremendously important to stop the leaf burning in your own backyard, to teach stewardship of every sort of soul, salvation, of community, of earth, of person that I described before as our needs. But let's remember that they're also part of a bigger world. And your job to get people interested in it, to know they're inconvenienced by any gains you have. If I told you that you had to write a story on a giornamento in the Oddfellows Lodge or the Knights of Pythias or the Sons of Hermann, well, stockbrokers jump out of windows. I don't know what people like you would do these days. You know that that's how a lot of people look at us if we're only local, if we don't somehow find ways to connect. if we aren't connected with that larger world, we're also not connected with that order around us. We have withdrawn spiritually, and that's been very important for us. What the Quakers call the inward journey was neglected in the 60s when we acted as if we were political action agencies that could spill out into the world. By we, I don't mean most people. But I mean the people that the communicators noticed, the elites that did. And now we have to go back and feed the soul. So meditation and mysticism and metaphysics and miracle and message and all the other M's are back and should be. But again, the very act of their being back might distance us even more. We know these aren't good years for large organizations in religion, as any of you who have joined the Walking Wounded as members of the PR staffs of World Council, National Council, or denomination would know. Even the more impromptu and recent ones, Consultation on Church Union, Key 73, Lausanne 74, the truism is out. Those things worked if they worked locally. But just as every candidate is running against Washington, every candidate in the church is also running against Rome and Geneva and New York and Minneapolis and St. Louis and Tulsa and all the rest. And you stand in the place that those occupy. I don't think you're competitive with each other, by the way, and I see no reason for you to be. Sometimes people say, you at the University of Chicago, you must really be trying to do in Harvard, Yale, Union, Vanderbilt, Notre Dame, Berkeley. That's not the competition. The competition is apathy. The competition is ignorance. The competition is people who don't know the faintest thing of what any of you are about. And you could busy yourselves all the rest of this year without getting on each other's toes in trying to get out the basic basics of the message we're talking about. So this afternoon I've tried to suggest that we're set up in communications to communicate beyond the local in a time when people are interested in the local. We are set up to engage in sustained communication in a time when most things are immediate and ad hoc. We're set up for the programmed when what is around is the spontaneous. And you have difficulties. You don't have celebrities. After Pope John and Billy Graham, name one that the whole public knows. If you are PR for an evangelist or a cause or a best-selling author, you'll have a clientele, but you won't have a public. So you have to do it without celebrities, and I'm not sure we need look for them. Yes, Mother Teresa, Dorothy Day, there are people like that around, but try it on Chestnut Street and Market Street and see how many people have heard of them, even if their time covers. Acronyms won't help. WCC, NPRC, what are you this year? PRPRC.
RPRC.
RPRC, it changes all the time. Two of them in one story means you've lost your readers, by the way. Christian Century often will have the UNITED of the NCFOLD Task Force of the RCOLM Subcommittee of the NCOXQ of the World Council of Churches met in so on today. Acronyms do not impress people. Organizations don't. What do you do? I've suggested the strategy now for you is to create what's missing. By the words you use, the images you project, the sympathies you have, the personal interests that quicken you, you're the storytellers at the point of connection and nexus between the local and the translocal, between the religiously withdrawn and the public exposed. You won't have and you won't always need formal big organizations for that. What you really need is your own alertness, your own imagination, and each other. Cor ad cor loquitur was the motto of John Cardinal Newman, heart speaketh unto heart. PR in the past was so preoccupied with the boundaries of things. Where did Catholicism start and Protestantism begin? Where did my evangelist territory start and your turf begin? Where does our good name end and your good name begin? We aren't interested now so much in the boundaries. We're interested in the heart and the center. Cor ad cor loquitur, heart speaketh unto heart. I hope that the morale that is gained by your coming together these days, I hope the recognitions that you've shared with each other, the experiences you've had and the ideas you have will help motivate you to be part of that nexus, that network, that connection that's so needed in our time. Thank you.